We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. You can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by the co-authors of a new book out June 14th. It's called Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. Pete Hegseth and David Goodwin, welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
So, Pete, our audience is definitely familiar with you. I'm sure everyone's seen you on Fox News, but since it's your first time on this show, on Federalist Radio Hour, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you ended up where you are?
Sure. Thanks again for having us. I grew up in, you know, middle America and in Minnesota, went to public high school, which is certainly relevant for the conversation we're going to have today. I went off to school, joined the military, did a couple of tours, became a sort of an activist in a sense on vets and military causes, and then stumbled my way onto TV. And now I get a chance to be a part of the national conversation, which as a vet, I take seriously to give voice to our generation of guys and gals, but also just as a patriot and a citizen who, you know, knows that we're in the middle of information warfare. And to at Fox and at Fox Nation to have the blessing of a platform to try to make the case for the things we care the most about. And in the case of this book and this project with David, it is, you know, the minds of our most precious resource, which is our kids and our grandkids. I've got a bunch of them. He does too. So do your listeners, kids and grandkids and others. And the future of our country is at stake if we don't figure out how to pump out kids that don't hate America and understand where their freedoms come from and that there is something bigger than the state and what our biblical history is. So This is I've written a couple of books before, and this is far, you know, humbly spoken. This is far more important than any of the other stuff that I wrote about, which was about politics or culture. This is the front lines. You know, we talk about politics and culture all the time, but what happens behind those classroom doors shapes the minds of our youngest. And we're seeing some of the worst examples of it today. And David and I are trying to do something about it.
Mm, truly so important. Now, David, tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I have a considerably more conventional background. I grew up on a farm in Idaho, but actually ended up at a state college, got an MBA, went to work for one of the big tech companies, spent 13, 14 years there, and realized that there was a storm brewing. And that I needed to get involved and try and do some things. I had been previously involved in church ministry at some level, but it was showing me that the level of depth and the consistency between people's faith and their view of the world was broken. And so, when I found classical education, it scratched that itch.
Mm. Yeah. And the book is really centered around this tradition of classical Christian education. So let's start off I'll start with you, David, and then Pete, you can add to it. What is classical Christian education? How do you define it?
Well, it was the form of education that existed. You know, it's funny, people don't know what it is now, but for 2,000 years, it was the only form of education practiced in the West. And so it primarily educated every one of our founding fathers. It educated that generation. It educated all the generations in the 19th century. What it is essentially what's been called the seven liberal arts. This was originated in Greece and Rome, but it continued to develop through the entirety of Western civilization. And it had a different purpose than seeking jobs. Its purpose was to prepare people to be citizens in a free society, because in order to do that, the Greeks had it right. I mean, they were the first democracy we have recorded. And they were fearful that any democracy was going to be condemned to tyranny as soon as the populace could be swayed by clever arguments. Mm-hmm. So they established the original trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, to train people, train young children in how to think clearly so that they could discern good arguments from bad. And that was the base ingredient of democracy, both in Greece and then later in Rome, and even in the Western tradition of government all the way through. When you look at the Magna Carta, the idea of self-government required a free-thinking citizen, and that's why it was called the liberal arts. It didn't have anything to do with politics in per se in the sense of liberal. It just meant that they could think freely. Mm-hmm. And so we practice that. That is the basis of our classical Christian schools, the seven liberal arts.
And Pete, you write about how this history of classical education, classical Christian education, has been forgotten. Why do you think it is that our history of this tradition has sort of been lost in the way we look back on the founding of the country?
Because it was intentionally targeted. The progressives knew it was an impediment to their utopian atheist dream of societal control or equity, as it's talked about now. So you had to get rid of liberating minds so that you could control minds, and you had to get rid of the understanding of human nature, of theology, of philosophy, of history, of civics. So very intentionally, openly, but stealthily, the left started changing the definition of words and priorities. And pretty soon, fast forward to 1970, which I would call the darkest point in American education, there were zero classical Christian schools in America, zero of them. And the movement that David leads was basically rediscovered in the 80s and 90s, to the point where now we have in David's network over 400 brick and mortar classical Christian schools across the country. There are, you know, in 46 states. There are online options, tens of thousands of people. There's homeschooling options, curriculum options. If you want to find this alternative, you can find it. But it was buried for so long that sometimes it's unrecognizable. So you walk into a classical Christian school. Yes, there are classrooms and desks and all of the things that you, but they've had to whittle away at all the progressive layers that have been added to school that we're not even aware of. So I went to a public school. I thought I got a great education. It was a progressive education. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Certainly my elite college education was all, you know, radical left-wing stuff, but even the basic public schools of the 80s and 90s were along the trajectory of where what we see today, and not in, just in left-wing communities, but across the country. So David's network has revived this, and it's creating the type of students that would have written the Declaration of Independence, because they understand. And I say, I mean, that sounds haughty-taughty, but I mean that in a basic sense, that understand all the arguments. They've grappled with the big ideas. They've read the great books. They understand the criticisms. They know how to speak Latin, so they can read history in its authentic form. They understand where words originate from, so they can't be manipulated. They've gone through three iterations of world history, leveled at the grade at which they can appropriately synthesize information. So young kids love facts and they gather up facts and they like to know them. Well, by the time you get to middle school, you want to kind of dissect those facts and identify a fallacy or a bad argument. And then by the time you're in the upper school, which is called rhetoric, you're debating those ideas and building a discussion and defending a thesis way beyond what anyone in public education right now is learning, because it all gets dumbed down. And of course, God has been removed and now America's the bad guy and climate change is the religion. And that's what's so scary about our moment. But what I love about working on this project with David is we're not just screaming with this book about what's wrong. Mm. The biggest part of the book is part three, which is five chapters about the solution. Here's what you can do. Here's where you can go. You know, take that move.
Right. And the book presents itself as a field guide of sorts. And part of the reason I think this project resonated personally is because I had a really similar experience to you, Pete. I thought I had a great public school education in Wisconsin. And it turns out, looking back, it was very secularized. One of the things you talk about that needs to be targeted is these progressive assumptions that are even baked into Christian educations, even baked into homeschooling programs. Pete, what are some of those progressive assumptions that we just kind of take for granted at this point?
Yeah, I mean, take something as simple as social studies or the social sciences, right? I mean, we all took it. You took it. I took it. I didn't think anything of it. But what they have done is get rid of individual disciplines like history or like economics or like geography or like philosophy or like politics that in and of themselves are important to understand, and then bringing them all together with an individual understanding of each and then how they affect each other. And then inside a Christian worldview that allows you to understand God's purpose for your life and the relationship between God and man, to answer big questions like, why am I here? What is my purpose? What is good? What is evil? What is courageous? What is wisdom? Those are words you didn't hear in Wisconsin and I didn't hear in Minnesota in my public school education. And so even the assumptions of how we teach, what we teach, the words we use are part of a long-term transformation that certainly we couldn't notice in one generation because it seemed normal to us where we were because we didn't know what happened 10 years ago or 40 years ago, but over time have totally overturned the apple cart. I mean, David has a great analogy in the book. He talks about if a giant cargo ship is tipped over on its side and you're living in it for 100 years, that becomes your normal. The wall is the floor. But once you turn that ship back upright, you start to realize what it's supposed to look like. And that's part of what classical Christian does, is this right-sized the ship again and said, no, this is how we did education before progressives took it over. And the results are staggering. I mean, when I go into a classical Christian school, all I can say is what I would give to have had this education myself. And now all I want is to give it to my kids, to give them so that they're not playing from behind, rediscovering. I'm 42 and I'm learning every day what I didn't know. And we all learn throughout the course of our lives, but the baseline was never really there. So it's catch up. And I want to give that baseline to the next generation so we can go on the offense, because right now we're losing on every single level. But the idea that God is sprinkled on top. I think a lot of, you know, Christian schools, that's what's happened. It's like, over here is your progressive education. And oh, by the way, God is there too. And that's great, but it doesn't change the way you think and how you, and David, you can speak more to kind of how the progressive side sneaks into, you know, Christian and private schools too.
Yeah. David, do you have anything to add on that point?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the progressives, like they do so often, they frame the debate, and they frame the debate early in the 20th century where they said religion is a personal thing and it's off to the side. And then we have truth, which is a scientific thing, which we do kind of in these pragmatic studies. And in fact, Christianity is a truth system. That's what it, I mean, it's many other things, but it is certainly a truth system. And by that, it means that we can see, you know, I think C.S. Lewis has this phrase where he says, it's not that I look at the sun to see, it's that by it, I see everything else. And that's the nature of classical Christian education, is the view of everything else through the light cast by Christianity. And where this really matters, for example, I'll just give a concrete example. In our schools, you mentioned sort of the subjects you took in your public schools. In our schools, we have kind of these integrated classes that cover everything from history, literature, philosophy, theology, art. It's all together. And the kids sit around these big tables. And the job is to train them to think. So we use something called the Socratic method to ask good questions and then let the students interact with each other, trying to sharpen their understanding. And that, with Christianity as the backdrop, where you always come back to it and say, yeah, but if this is true, then what Marx said has to be seen this way. And it's not necessarily an indoctrination education. In fact, it's the furthest thing from it. It's an education that takes apart every argument and claims it in a Christian context.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and 2 washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist.
Mm-hmm. And the book covers, and before we get to the solutions, which I do think is such an important element of this, and it's one that some people punt on, the progressive heist, there's a lot of history in the book. And I think it's helpful to understand exactly how the progressive movement, especially in the last century plus, has intentionally targeted the education system. So I'll start with you, David, and then go to Pete. Tell us about the progressive heist, what people should know about it, and, you know, how the book approaches that subject.
Well, I'll just start with my journey of discovery. So I went to a lecture at one point with a Hillsdale professor who quoted an early progressive who said that they were seeking to control the plasticity of the child. And I thought that an odd word. So I couldn't quite catch the reference. And I went to the library. This story is told in the first part of the book. I went to the library to find the thing, thinking that an educational passage in a magazine by the progressives in the early part of the 20th century called the New Republic.
Yes.
I figured it wouldn't be that hard to find the one article they must have had on education where this was placed. And then I quickly found that like every issue had education in it. And so that clued me in that this was a big deal. This is 1915, 1916, 1917. So I'm reading through it, published every 2 weeks. So I'm going through John Dewey's publishing almost consistently during those years. And I realize this plasticity comment is part of a much bigger idea, which is they couldn't get their hands on the children in America because the children were raised in what this thing called the paideia. Now, people will hear that. Maybe their eyes will glaze over a little bit because that's not a term we hear a lot anymore. But paideia at the time was well known. And they knew that by shifting children's whole vision of the good life and their view of what is the root of truth and how do they come to know it, all these big questions, by shifting that, they could take over the control of the country. So their first action was to place something new in the place of Christianity, which was an American paideia, which they called it. And many of us see that and we think, oh yeah, that's good stuff. Things like the Pledge of Allegiance and flags and, you know, George Washington pictures in the front of the classroom. But all that, as good as it was really just we call it in the book, it was like a forgery that they put on the pressure plate to keep us from noticing that they pulled God and Christianity out of schools. And so once they had Americanism stuck there, it's easy to take America and make it whatever you want to make it. And that's where we're at today. I'll leave you, Pete, to discuss where we went from there.
Exactly. So things like the Pledge of Allegiance, which we all revere, was actually written by Francis Bellamy in the early, late 19th century, an avowed socialist. Did not include under God when it was first written. It was added in the 50s by Eisenhower when we were battling the godless Soviets. And it was all meant to create allegiance to the state, something that they could get, you know, parents to agree on effectively. If you had removed God outright, they would have rejected that. And they debated this all openly in publications. Then they experimented with new forms of school systems, like in Gary, Indiana. They created the Gary Plan, a school where they said, God is out, basically going to do a pullout period. And then they debated how to bring it to New York. And some of those things worked and some of them didn't. And meanwhile, while this is all going on, they're basically, their intention is to secularize the school so they can move on from there. Well, enter the Frankfurt School, which is a Marxist German group that fled Hitler in the 30s, that landed at Columbia University. And this isn't a perfect timeline, a lot happened throughout, but landed in the 1930s at Columbia Teachers College. And where do you get something like critical race theory? Well, you get it from critical theorists who pump it into the pipeline in the 30s and 40s into our most prominent teachers college, and then proliferated across the country. And then eventually you have the emergence of political teachers unions, which used to be very conservative teacher associations that handed out scripture and Bible verse readers to students. Now they're being captured by public sector unions. The Supreme Court does its job by banning school prayer and the Ten Commandments. And then you're off to the races, creating the Department of Education. The unions created the Department of Education. And then Howard Zinn shows up with his anti-American textbook, and they all celebrate it and push it forward. So it's not as if the progressives knew exactly where they were heading. And every generation may have had a different view of what progress meant in that sense. But they knew exactly where they weren't going. And it was never toward God, and it was never toward celebrating Western civilization or America's founding. And so that's how you get to our current moment, where parents pop up during COVID-19 and go, whoa, where did these gender pronouns for my 8-year-old come from? And what is the 1619 project? And why is my school teaching it? Mm. And it seems like it popped up out of nowhere. But when you look at the actual history, they've been toiling over the soil for 100 years, to the point where they felt confident enough to just come out and say it. I mean, we are well past the bias phase, even past the indoctrination phase. Now we're into the activism phase, where their goal is to create, you know, scientists with raised fists out there to right every wrong based on a worldview that they define and self-identity.
Yeah, and you guys write there's, quote, a straight line from critical theory to Antifa. And this post-Enlightenment period of industrialization really landed on this period of elite secularization. Like, they targeted, as you guys write, they targeted God first. And this is the Pride Month, which has created all kinds of examples of what's happened to public school educations, even to private school educations. And I wonder, I was talking to some Hillsdale folks actually about this last night. If you guys could talk about, this may seem like a strange transition, but if you guys could talk about why you specifically zero in on wonder and beauty in the book, and how, when we see things like the 1619 Project or, you know, drag queen story hour treated as something that is a promotion of beauty, how do all of these concepts sort of fit together in the larger puzzle? Whoever wants to take it.
David. Yeah, I'll chime in, but David, you start.
Yeah, that portion of the book has four pillars or four towers that make up the kind of the old fortress that was classical education. And beauty and wonder, it's interesting you would pick on those, because they're the last. Beauty was the first one to be destroyed because people said it was in the eye of the beholder. When you do that, suddenly beauty becomes something personal, which means it really doesn't matter anymore, because you get to decide what you want. So we lost art early on. We lost, you know, if you go to 19th century art and you compare it to 20th century art, it doesn't take a doctorate to know that there's a difference aesthetically in what you've got. Wonder is the more sort of mysterious one to people, but I really saw it when I worked in classical education, because young children, if you don't provide any framework for them to believe things in or to see things in, like we do, for example, something in classical schools called nature studies a lot, where the students will observe a leaf, for example, or some part of a tree, and they'll draw it. And the point of that is not just for art. The point of it is to observe carefully. Well, if you think about it, it's a submission to the world the way it is. And when we come to all this LGBT madness that's going on, it's a rejection of the world the way it is. They're insisting on it mm-hmm. undermines wonder, because you cannot wonder effectively. You can't create a sense in children of wonder if there's nothing to wonder about. If there's no God who created, if there's no world to discover, then you have nothing to wonder about. And that is the essence of classical education's focus on wonder, is let's put some boundaries in here where kids can appreciate and love that which has been made and that which is, not that which they want to be. And then within that construct, they can wonder.
Yeah, I had a chance to go out and meet a bunch of great teachers and administrators of classical Christian schools throughout the process. And one was an art teacher at a school in Tennessee. And she showed us the artwork of, you know, 12, 13, 14 year olds. And it's something I could never create right now, even close. And it, you know what she said? She said it's a trained skill. She said it's a trained skill that you refine that is important, used to be very important, and has been completely rejected for the reasons David said. What is art when everything is beautiful and nothing is beautiful and it's all in the eye of the beholder? Classical Christian education rejects that and says there is such a thing as beauty, and it is a reflection of God and his creation. And through our attempt to make beautiful things or create them, we're servicing and reflecting that eternal beauty that God has imprinted on us and in his creation. And it's just, when you wrap it all together that way, it makes sense for kids, and they have a purpose for what they're doing. And the other two battlements David talks about, we write about, are virtue and reason. You know, the idea of, and we talk about the word values, which values is the lexicon I use forever, which is actually quite different than the idea of virtue, which was always the phrase that was used inside Christendom for 2000 years. And values became something anyone could have based on whatever your values are. Same thing with reason, which is totally under assault. Reasoning, and we get into the College Board and the SAT test, which, because not everyone was achieving the same scores, well, the test had to be racist, and the people who created Common Core took over the SAT. And what's the first thing they did? Get rid of the reasoning requirement. So it's not now how well you reason, it's how well you can study for the test based on your understanding of Common Core, which means the SAT is no longer like the odometer on your car measuring the strength of the engine. It is driving the car. And that means you're getting less well-prepared students in higher education as well. So when I first started this project with David, him being the expert of classical Christian education, I looked at words like wonder and beauty. I'm like, what is this guy talking about? Like, I don't really know what that has to do with education. But then the deeper you dive into it, you realize how central it is and why it has been so under assault, all the way now to the cover of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. You know, there's manifestations of it around us.
Yeah, and David talked earlier about his journey of discovery. And Pete, it strikes me, you know, as somebody who spends a lot of time in Manhattan and, you know, works for probably one of the only places in media where it's okay to be heterodox and counter-narrative to what the elites say. But still, Manhattan is a very secular, progressive place, and a lot of people who work in media are very secular and progressive. What was your kind of discovery journey like? When did you realize, looking back on your public school education that you thought was great in Minnesota, when did it sort of click in your mind that this was all of these progressive assumptions had basically been baked into that?
Mine was a winding, flawed path of destruction and wreckage that led me. I mean, we write at the beginning of the book, like, I really do come at this project with nothing but humility as a sinner, like everyone else who does not have life figured out, but is grateful that I have a Lord and Savior who redeems me. And I look at the careening of trying to figure a lot of this stuff out, which, of course, we still don't have fully figured out, as what I would like to help a lot of my kids avoid, at least as a baseline. Everyone's going to make their own choices and make their own mistakes and learn from them. But without that baseline, you're learning something here and then taking two steps back over here. And then you don't even know what you don't know. And then you don't know how to argue against it. I mean, ultimately, I went to a liberal university and was repulsed by it. And so had to re-educate myself in a basic sense to try to find a way to fight back imperfectly. And then went into the military and was confronted with real evil and raw human nature and a lot of humility in that process. I had personal twists and turns in my life that sent me up and sent me down. And ultimately, it sent me back to the cross as the only thing that redeems us and informs humility and an understanding of human nature. And then I looked around and realized these schools that these kids are in are not cutting it. But I didn't know that the next five chapters of the solution section. Like, I just didn't know yet what that looks like. I'm still like every other conservative saying, well, let's do some school choice and, you know, get them out. And those are good things, but they're utterly insufficient when you consider the headwinds of what we're up against as a culture. And meeting David and reading the research that he had done, question and answers and challenging assumptions, the light bulb went off, I would say, during this project, honestly, that as we were writing it, as David uncovered what he did in the early 20th century, and I started with the stuff we're yelling about on Fox, and then we both kind of worked toward the middle and met, and we're like, yeah, it's all been one giant line. And that's where you go from critical theory to Antifa. It's the same line of thinking that got us here. And we want to help reveal that to so many other people, because the only way the path to recovery in any context is understanding the depth of your problem. And that's why the problem identification of this is so important, because there are so many wonderful, good conservative Christian people in America who are doing the best they can and praying their kids will be okay and trying to do right by them. And they're missing the mark because they don't realize how far gone the very institutions they trust in, not just public schools, but private schools and many Christian schools are. And so this is a giant raising awareness campaign while also pointing toward this form of education that was lost and is now found.
Yeah, I'm so glad you say that, because we talk all the time on the show about how the left sneered at all of those campus craziness segments that Fox was really the only major media outlet paying any attention to. And now some of those same people are just very scared about the death of free speech. And it was sort of there under their noses all along. Mm-hmm. So, David, Pete's mentioned that you work in this space. And I think there's this big question of how can a specifically Christian education be meaningfully revived in such a secular world where they've knocked down that first pillar of God, which led to knocking down the pillar of truth and then beauty and everything else. So what does this field guide suggest? What are some really concrete paths to a better education system?
Well, first thing, I think we have to have some of the virtues, if I may say, that the progressives had early on. They, 100 years ago, 120 years ago now, realized that the path to political control and to the control of the country was through education. And they started investing long, long before the fruits would pay out. And so I think we have to be at least that dedicated to investing in education of this form, this revolutionary form, which can be substantiated in history, and that's in the book, of all the various ways in which classical education has changed societies over time. So we have to be as disciplined as they were to go after the hard solution, not the quick solution, and to dedicate our kids to that. Now, the second bit of more hopefulness in that, given that, you know, public schools hold about 90% of the students in the country, so it would be pretty hard to overcome that, is that in any society in which classical Christian education has been established, a very small minority is able to use the strength of rhetoric, for example, and logic to really magnify and create a multiplier for their influence on the culture. Because when you have something, I mean, grammar, logic, rhetoric, the Greek trivium, that format is not made for highfalutin kind of fancy people only. Its main purpose is to communicate to the average citizen what it is that is true, what is good, and what is beautiful. And if you can do that with 6, 8, 10% of the graduates in this country, you can control the country.
Pete, what would you add to that? And I'll ask this question with an additional caveat, which is the book starts with COVID-19, the COVID-19 moment. I think it's the introduction of the first chapter. Has COVID created an environment in which it's actually more possible now than it has been? People are sort of aware of the failures of our education system to implement some of these changes.
Absolutely. And we started this project together, first on a film and then the manuscript, everything, right as it was all starting, before we call it the COVID-16-19 moment. So parents are at home on Zoom classrooms seeing. And that was right when the 1619 Project stuff was coming out, and America's inherently a racist country, and anti-racism, and then gender pronouns, and as parents, like, what in the world? What am I looking at here? So it was a confluence of those two things that created an awareness moment where parents started looking around and immediately was like, well, do I homeschool? Do I pull them out? What are my alternatives? And even I didn't understand the scope of the alternatives, not just David's brick and mortar schools, but as we talked about online options and homeschooling options, they're out there. If you want to find it, you can find it. And so we do have this, it feels like a providential opportunity based on this virus that actually exposed a way more dangerous virus that was inside our schools of indoctrination of our kids. And the argument that we make in the book is, you're not going to change this by incrementally protesting at school boards and hoping you can win over a school board election and change a little bit, maybe get the pledge back in your school or something. That's all good and nice to have. And I'm not arguing against that, but it's utterly insufficient. And the analogy I use in the book is, it's like charging a fortified machine gun nest with Nerf guns. Like, we salute your efforts, but we're going to bury you in the end, you know, because you're not going to win. The educational industrial complex in this country is too strong. So what we argue for in the solution section is effectively a tactical retreat in a military context, an insurgency. Insurgency is the warfare of the small against the big, of the little guy against the powerful. And Mao had three phases of insurgency that he used effectively as a communist. We studied them in the military. I taught them as an instructor of counterinsurgency. We're in phase one of insurgency, which is effectively assessing what you have at your disposal and trying to build your infrastructure and your networks. And that's what's so encouraging about what David says. This isn't the 70s. We have a system and curriculum in classical Christian that exists, and we have schools across America, and they're growing, they're booming. And there are more opening every year and more online options. But the grip of the assumption of school and public school and the sort of the nostalgia of public school is still there, right? I mean, people still want to give to their alma mater, even though their alma mater is full of Marxists. They still give to them because they like the college football team. You know, we say we still have the same affinity for our prom, and, you know, we want the same thing for our kids, and all that Americana that we associate with is really hard to rip people away from, myself included. I assumed my kids would go to public school. I wanted them to go to the big Friday night football game and do all those are all tough things to come up against. But with all that we're coming up against in our culture, I think we have a moment to kind of shake parents and say, of all the responsibilities that you have, the imprinting on their youngest of souls and hearts when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old is going to reverberate for the rest of their life. Don't hand them over to a progressive or a bureaucrat who has an agenda. Take control of it. My co-host of Fox and Friends, Rachel Campos Duffy, said, hey, I love that people are protesting at school boards, but who has time to do that? And why right. Why am I protesting a school that I'm sending my kids to? Why wouldn't I want to find something that reinforces what I believe? And that's why I'm so encouraged. I had forgotten to emphasize what David did. It's not that you're going to take over every school. It's the amplifying effect of the 3, 4, 5, 6% of really fortified young kids entering our society. And we're seeing more of that ecosystem with other universities that are catering toward classical Christian thinking because there's an appetite out there for it. And that just needs to expand even more. And then there are other phases, full educational choice, educational tax credits, and challenging the monopoly of the public school system is part of what we argue in phase two and phase three. But this is a long-term project. And David's right. We have to learn from how intentional the progressives were and stop trying to just fight this at the political level and get involved at the school level.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how Rachel has time to do anything at all.
Me too.
All right. Well, Pete Hegseth and David Goodwin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for
thank
giving us
you so much.
To talk about it.
Of course. Well, the book is called Battle for the American Mind, Uprooting a Century of Miseducation. I know this conversation was of interest to our audience, so make sure you go get that book when it's out on June 14th. We're so appreciative of your time, Pete and David. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.